you. I think I'll start from where Mark went on. And that's the old system that we had, both in terms of finance and the real economy after the Second World War, when Keynes actually put his stamp on the Bretton Woods system. And I think he understood that there was a difference between finance and the real economy. Finance is a servant, and the real economy is a master. That's the way it should be. If you leave the market system totally unregulated, both trade and finance and everything else, then finance would be the master. The tail would wag the dog, and not the dog would wag the tail. So the Bretton Woods system was instituted in which finance was put in its place, and the real economy of production and trade, would be driving the car, and finance would be the fuel. That's very bad for climate change, but I mean that's the analogy at that time. And so we had actually the IMF playing its role, and its role was very boring but very important. That is to actually be part of a system of capital controls. As Mark has said, countries were not supposed to allow capital to just flow freely. They would flow if they serve the real economy of trade and investment and production. But you wouldn't have the US allowing banks and funds which just to allow capital to flow autonomously without it being linked to trade and production. IMF was part of this system of capital controls. Secondly, it regulated exchange rates, which were fixed at what was supposed to be fundamental values linked to the real economy. And if the exchange rate became misaligned, then you can change the exchange rate under heavy IMF conditions, which were imposed mainly on developed countries like the UK. And that served the economy very well until 1973. This was a period of the golden age of growth and everything else. Finance was tame and became the servant, and it collapsed in 1973. We know why the US would not exchange gold anymore, because they spent too much of their money in the Vietnam War. Very familiar, it's happening again now with Afghanistan and Iraq. But that freed the exchange rates, and therefore exchange rates became the subject of speculation. That also led to progressive liberalization of the financial system, starting with the OECD countries, and then the OECD countries trying to export that to the developing countries. Through example, through pressure of FTAs and WTO, and through the IMF wanting to change its Articles of Association in 1968 so that capital account liberalization would be part of the IMF's job. Before that, it was only current account liberalization. By current account, we meant trade and foreign investment. But with capital account, we also mean the autonomous flow of short-term capital, which was not in the mandate of the IMF and still is not, and they would have got the articles changed in Hong Kong in 1998, except that the Asian crisis prevented them from doing so. Fortunately, so Asia became the sacrifice. We sacrificed our economy so that we could prevent the IMF from doing it. Somebody must have planned the whole thing to prevent the IMF. Otherwise, it would have been compulsory for countries under the IMF to liberalize their capital account. So what happened? We had the US. I think the US did a very bad thing. They decided somehow or other, or it was unplanned, to sacrifice the manufacturing sector. That has gone into a decline. Many jobs are lost. We've been talking to the unions. Manufacturing in the US has gone down. Now, maybe it's due to the US allowing its tariffs to go down too fast. Maybe it's due to the free trade agreements. Maybe it's due to miscalculation or negligence. But what happened was the fastest growing sector was not only services, but financial services. I think we have all those figures. You know, financial services was 15% of corporate profits and it went up to 40%. So we had the ballooning and the fattening of finance and the shrinking of the real economy in manufacturing while still trying to maintain something in agriculture through very unethical means of subsidy and so on, whilst forcing other countries to open up their agriculture by reducing their tariffs. So US agriculture could still maintain itself but not becoming very much bigger. Manufacturing was shrinking, and what boosted was this, the financial services sector. And this is why the US promoted financial liberalization around the world, because it thought that its competitive sector was finance, and if it could export its model of finance, then US financial institutions abroad could make those fat profits and take it home, where it would be the fastest growing sector, and never mind if manufacturing collapses. So today we have Citibank laying off 50,000 workers. The fat cow is becoming thinner. And maybe it will become malnutrition for some time before it gets back to its optimal weight. So you're going to have a crisis here. More manufacturing, agriculture, cheat the world and try to maintain it. And the services sector is shrinking. But the solutions that the US is having, in fact, there are many positive aspects from a Keynesian point of view. Is going back to some kind of Keynesian thing. I'm sure eventually with wisdom prevailing to some degree and with CEBR playing its role, finance will become the tail again to some degree. It will take some time, but it's moving so fast we never expected it. It will become the tail and not. The dog will start wagging the tail again. That's good for the US, it's good for the EU. Nobody thought about the developing countries. So the following are 8 points in which I thought US-EU policies, which may make sense for EU and US, plus G20 statement and the policies that are coming, may have negative consequences on the developing countries and are already having. You see, you have finance and the real economy. Finance collapse. That caused many repercussions on developing countries. Real economy is collapsing in US-EU. That has even more repercussions on developing countries. So the channel through which this crisis is having an impact on developing countries is the finance channel, the investment channel, and the trade real economy channel. These three channels are now coming into full play in the developing countries, and we are about to have the full force of both finance and the real economy crisis into developing countries, and we are going to suffer much more than the US is suffering because you have instruments and tools for which you can then reflate. And many developing countries don't have those instruments and tools. Secondly, you control the international financial architecture and its reform, and therefore you can use that to improve your situation. But in doing so, that same international system that is being refashioned may not be helping the developing countries, but may make the situation worse. So we will have these two impacts. I'm going to go very fast. Firstly, the subsidies going to US banks and European banks may make the third world financial institutions themselves less competitive because we don't have the money to subsidize. We don't have $2 trillion to pump into Citibank and JP Morgan and the refashioning of the investment banks and the insurance companies and everything else. So when one side has all the trillions of dollars to subsidize and the other side doesn't have, then our financial institutions find weakness and don't get the subsidies, they are going to suffer relatively and may be facing collapse without rescue. Yours face collapse with rescue. There's life after collapse. Many people feel that Chapter 11 is wonderful. GM should go under Chapter 11. Then they will have life after Chapter 11. We don't have Chapter 11 and we don't have life after Chapter 11. We have death. So this is a problem. The other thing is, knowing that the US and EU will not let their big institutions fall and that they will guarantee investors and savers, this leads to a flight to safety, including the safety of bailouts. So we now have massive capital outflows from the developing countries. in terms of investors moving out from the stock market portfolio and so on. And in future, if I were a long-term investor, I would rather seek refuge in the US and the EU, because that's where the safety is, even if the profit rate in the short term is lower. Yeah. So this flight to safety factor is going to affect the developing countries a lot. Thirdly, with the US playing this great bailout role, the currency has improved in the US. I mean, the US dollar has strengthened against what people would have thought 4 or 5 months ago. That may be good or bad for the US, I don't know. Maybe it's bad for your trade competitiveness, but it's good for your being able to attract capital to fill in the deficits and so on. It's very bad for developing countries that borrowed in US dollars. Suddenly they have a debt crisis. It's a replay of the Asian debt crisis. Korea, currency fell 30-40%, a very strong country. You know, what happens to India, South Africa, other countries where the currencies are falling and where there is substantive foreign debt? They lose a lot in terms of the local currency they have to put up in order to service their loans. That has become a major issue for many developing countries that have foreign debt and have low reserves. Like Pakistan has gone bankrupt. And then you have the combination of the depreciation of currency in a developing country with the fall in reserves because of the outflow of short-term capital, plus the trade surplus decreasing or the trade deficit increasing in many countries because of the effects of the real economy, and you have a balance of payments crisis, you have rapid deterioration of foreign reserves, and a long queue outside the IMF looking for bailouts. Then you have the real economy effect of through the trade channel in two ways. One is collapse of commodity prices. Commodity prices went up very fast due to real demand going up, for example, through China. Plus, speculators going into the commodity markets because they found that they didn't get enough profit through the equity market. So they went into the commodity market, not only for oil, but for many other commodities. So with real demand falling, plus the speculators finding that there's no profit anymore in the future, leaving the commodity markets, we have a total reversal of what we had 3-4 months ago when the FAO had this big seminar. Okay, food price gone up, commodity price going up, oil price going up, developing countries not knowing what to do if they are importers. To the reverse today, which is food prices going down so fast that the food exporters and commodity exporters who are not food exporters going into a tailspin. My own country, Malaysia, our major export is palm oil, which goes into margarine, cooking oil, and so on. The price had jumped to 4,500 Malaysian dollars in March. That was a peak. Today it has fallen to 1,500 Malaysian dollars per ton. And the latest forecast is next year it will fall to below 1,000. Okay, so that's a fall of 65% to now, and another 50% to next year. And this is the major commodity for farmers in Malaysia, in Indonesia, these two countries, Thailand, and Ghana, and so on. So millions of these smallholders are now in dire straits, where they had become very rich only 6 months ago. Cotton, I saw the figures today in the press that it has fallen by 40-50%. That may affect your cotton farmers in the US, but you have the new US Farm Bill and the old US Farm Bill, so the trigger will be there and then they will be saved. But for those millions of farmers in Africa that, you know, have been fighting the US and the WTO over cotton, they are in a real mess. They are in a real mess. Soya bean, again, a big story in today's internet about Brazil. How the soya bean farmers in Brazil are in miserable straits because the price has fallen by 50%. In US, they are in slightly miserable straits, but you have the farm bill that will boost them in bad times. And then you have minerals, all kinds of minerals. Copper prices falling, aluminium, steel. Oil prices falling may be good news for a majority of developing countries, but for the 40 exporters, they are also in bad straits. Besides the commodity price channel, you have the manufacturing channel. Manufacturing exports are falling in developing countries because the consumer is beginning to reduce his expenditure here. It's been only over the last 2 to 3 months, so it's only the beginning phase. But we've had reports from China of millions of workers thrown out of jobs. In fact, we had statistics from our friend from China during an IFG meeting last weekend that even as US manufacturing jobs have been lost over the last many years, so has Chinese manufacturing jobs. This may be a surprise. But I did visit Tianjin, which is the biggest industrial area just outside Beijing, at the invitation of the top sort of international economists in China, in Tianjin University, is the top industrial economist. So we went to visit the free trade zone in 3,500 factories, and I said, oh, this must be an export. You know, jobs boom for Tianjin. He said, no, actually, we've done research and found that more jobs have been lost in my industrial city than the gains that we got from the free trade zones. And I said, why? Because we have all these local industries in textiles and so on. We have lost jobs because of China's accession to WTO and the drastic fall in our tariff. We've lost millions of jobs. And we have gained jobs in the export zone for export-oriented industries. But in net terms, we have lost massive amounts of jobs. So this was a surprise to me because it's counterintuitive from what you read in the papers. Now, this was a time when the manufacturing exports of China were booming. So now if you have that also being lost, plus the loss of local industrial jobs, you have massive job losses in China in manufacturing. A story which the world does not know. And I think the trade unions of both countries have to look at the situation rather than see one another as competitors or enemies. This is when the workers of the world have to unite again. Then the IMF story, of course, you see the G20 statement boosting the IMF, giving it a second life, and Japan giving another $100 billion to the IMF. We lived through the Asian financial crisis and saw IMF debt policies, which were double standards, on the grounds that we cannot have moral hazard in the developing countries, so local banks have to close down. You know what happened in Indonesia? You close down 3 bad banks. You didn't tell the other banks that their deposits are guaranteed. So everybody pulled their money out of good or bad banks, and the good banks collapsed as together with the bad banks. And there was massive capital flight of local capital, of local people to Singapore and other places, and that was disaster for the banking industry in Indonesia. Contrast that to what the US did here, or the Europeans did, which is to guarantee all bank deposits, to identify the bad banks, and to boost their capital and withdraw their bad assets. Something that the IMF said you cannot do to the Asians, and therefore allowed or facilitated or catalyzed the collapse of the financial institutions in Asia. So nobody wants to go back to the IMF. IMF, of course, asks us to raise the interest rates, allow free flow of capital, and reduce government expenditure. The most pro-cyclical set of policies you can think of. Look at the G20 statement. They said we have to be pro-cyclical, we have to be anti-cyclical rather than pro-cyclical, but the IMF did the opposite. And as Mark has said, and he has looked at IMF's latest conditions for Ukraine, Hungary, I think each other country, Iceland. Iceland was asked to put its interest rates up by 6 percentage points in one day. Right? Ukraine was asked to reduce its government expenditure from minus 2% of GNP deficit to a balanced budget. Total opposite of what the EU and US are doing, and total opposite of what the G20 are saying. So there's a contradiction there. G20 is saying use Keynesian and monetary methods to save yourself from recession. Maybe they were addressing that only to the developed countries. But at the same time, let's boost the IMF. And it did not say that the IMF has to take on the same reflationary policies. So if you boost the IMF with the 250 that they're going to spend plus 100 from Japan, and these $350 billion loans to developing countries are toxic. These are toxic IMF loans because they have toxic conditions linked to them. We are going to spread toxicity throughout not only the developing countries, but the countries in transition. So the G20 did not, I never saw the G20 saying that the IMF has to reform its conditionalities. It did not say that. So that's bad news. And finally, the G20 said that we all have to finish the Uruguay, we all have to finish the Doha round this year, the modalities. What are the modalities? The modalities not only include the fact that developing countries have to open up their agricultural sector without a safeguard mechanism, which India is fighting for. If you're going to finish the modalities, you have to give up this safeguard mechanism. The US and EU will be able to continue their high agricultural subsidies, pretending to reduce them but not actually reduce them. And the developing world will have to open up their manufacturing sector by cutting their tariffs from an average of 30 to 50% to something like 8 to 10%. And open up their services sector, particularly financial services, including new financial services and instruments. That has not changed. Nobody withdrew their proposals. So what are we doing in the Doha round? We are spreading the toxic financial system that is being disbanded here, but exporting it to developing countries at the same time without saying, I'm so sorry we have these proposals to export our dysfunctional model, which we are now throwing up. It's saying, you take on our toxic model while we are dismantling it here. Not only the US, the EU also through its economic partnership agreements. That's why I have a paper there. We've looked at the completed ETA with Cari Forum, the Caribbean countries. And A, it says free flow of funds, in other words, the opening of the total opening of the capital account, which the IMF actually gave up, but which is now coming in through the free trade agreements. Opening up of the financial services sector, a special chapter on that, and a provision on new financial instruments and services. That is that we are able to export European hedge fund activities and so on to you, whether you like it or not. Okay. This was completed 1 month ago, this EPA. So I would like to say that the EPA of the EU is obsolete. The financial crisis and it made it obsolete. Even the EU will not be able to do. But you know, the problem is this, there's no Caribbean hedge fund that can then invade the EU and violate its space now. But the reverse is true. The hedge funds that may now be regulated in the EU may float to the Caribbean. And the EPA will be also concluded in Africa and in Pacific. And they are doing new EPAs for Korea, for India, for Malaysia, for ASEAN. The US FTA is much worse than the EU one, because the EU at least does not have an expropriation clause that says that you can take up a case. In the US, you have an expropriation clause. In other words, the loss of any future earnings and profits will have to be compensated by the developing country to the US financial institution. If you commit yourself and you did not meet up to the commitments, we don't care why you didn't meet up to your commitments, you may say, oh, we are following what you did in the US because you changed your law, so I'm changing here. They say, I'm sorry. Your bank can take up a case against mine if you can't enter my territory, but there's no bank that can enter US territory. But my bank can also take up a case against yours, and of course there are many American banks that are going to go. So if we regulate the hedge funds and the investment banks and so on here, and we don't regulate them in developing countries because we didn't tell them how to regulate or we don't permit them to regulate, then you are going to find a transfer of this kind of toxic behavior to developing countries, which they have to accept because they are under an FTA, and which if they don't accept, or which if they now renounce, they may have to pay for it. So these are all the horror stories. Now the proposals. I have six proposals, very fast. Real reform to the IMF. How? Let the IMF play its traditional role of being the tail that actually regulates the dog in the right way. It's not just a passive tail, but a tail that actually regulates the dog in a proper way. Re-regulate currencies so that they stabilize. If not a fixed exchange rate system, something near to that. Make it legitimate for countries to impose capital controls on capital flows that are not related to trade or production, which is what the IMF was set up to do. When we say that, they say, how can the IMF do this? That was the reason why the IMF was set up, to have capital controls. In other words, institute or legitimize through an international network or through laws a system of capital controls that will regulate finance to serve the needs of industry. The IMF can help to re-regulate the finance sector if it knew how to do it. I don't think it knows how to do it. The banks have to go back to playing its role as banks and not as facilitators of casinos or themselves in casinos. Leverage that the banks give to speculators have to be reduced. For example, instead of the hedge funds being given a leverage of 50:1, and then they spin the 50 into positions of 1,000, so that with $1 you can have positions of 1,000 and speculate around the world. The banks can tell the hedge funds, like everyone else, I'll look at your collateral and I'll lend you 1:1. If you have a house worth $200,000, they will give you a mortgage of $200,000. Do that to the hedge funds. The hedge funds will go out of business. Well, that's their problem. Second, since the IMF cannot reform the way I've just put forward, build the other alternatives and let the IMF shrink away as it was shrinking away. At least, if the US and the IMF is not going to help facilitate competitors, do not stop the competitors when they want to come up. Don't help them, but don't stop them. Whether it's the stabilization fund that South America is trying to put together, or the Asians are trying to upgrade their Chiang Mai initiative into an $80 billion stabilization fund. They are eating problems. We don't know how to do it. We have to try to overcome the teething problems of politics, cohesion, will, and most important of all, I put it to some of the policymakers, I know why you're not really building these funds. You don't know that if you put in your $10 billion, whether you will get it back, because you don't know whether the country like Pakistan you're lending to will use it properly. And if they don't use it properly, how do you get the money back anyway? Unless you're willing to give it as a gift. Very few people are willing to give away gifts of $10 billion, $500 million maybe. So we have to solve that problem. Loans come with conditions. Question is, what is the economic model behind that condition? The IMF one is wrong. Maybe I don't mind lending to Pakistan or to South Africa or Korea, if it comes to the conditions that you have to reflate, you have to reduce your interest rates, you have to have capital controls, you have to stabilize your exchange rates. The total opposite of what the IMF conditions are, and the conditions which Malaysia, which defied the IMF, took on in 1997 to 2000. The kind of conditions that I was talking about. We reduced the interest rate, we reflated government expenditure, we fixed the exchange rate so it was stabilized, we instituted capital controls, and the economy recovered in 1 year, 2 years, and became the alternative to the IMF. Now, I don't mind putting my money into that kind of condition rather than the IMF kind of condition, because my kind of condition is more likely to succeed, and then I will recover the money, than putting into an IMF condition where I won't recover the money. FTAs have to change. The investment chapters of FTAs are extremely toxic and will facilitate the spread of financial crisis to developing countries, but not the solutions to the financial crisis. So the US will have a financial crisis and solve it, the developing countries will not. The services and financial services chapters of the US FTAs are very toxic. The zero tariff for industrial and agricultural products for developing countries are very toxic because we don't have subsidies to back up when companies and farmers go bankrupt. The US has, so it's not a level playing field. The developing countries, if they go to zero tariff under the USFTAs, will not have the revenue base on which they can reflate their economies, let alone give subsidies to their banks. And the competition chapter in the USFTAs is laughable if you look at what is happening in the US now. Okay? A government cannot help a private company or a government agency when that company or agency is in trouble. For example, you look at that chapter and you laugh. But it's still there. Now the US can violate, but the developing country is not going to challenge because it's not made any loss. It did not go to US and lose. But the developing country, if it violates because we start subsidizing, the US company in my developing country will complain and get compensation. It's a joke. The WTO has to change. Don't complete this Doha round because it is utterly flawed and will make the financial crisis worse. The pressures on developing countries to open up their financial services under plurilateral negotiations in the round has to stop. The US has to say, we are closing this negotiation, we are not putting pressure on you anymore. Because what we are pressurizing you to do is to take on a model that we are now rejecting. And we can't do that. Especially since my president's name is Obama, and he's a nice guy. So he can't do that, I'm withdrawing. That's what the US has to do. The US has an active proposal in the Rules Committee of WTO. If you look at it, it's worse than the FTA. You will laugh. You know what it says? 5 new proposals by the USTR 1 year ago. No WTO member shall have government providing loans to any institution, financial or otherwise, when those loans are not, when those institutions are not normally credit worthy. Okay? Another proposal, no government agency shall inject any equity into any private or government agency if that institution is not considered normally commercially equity friendly. In other words, if a normal private investor will not put it into a company because that is not it's not going to be sustainable from an equity point of view, the government should not do so. Those are only 2, there are another 3. You can laugh. Because when the US put this forward, the developing countries like China, India, Brazil, and said, this is very bad because we have a different industrial model than yours. You may not subsidize. Yes, we understand the US doesn't subsidize, but we do. Today, the US is the biggest subsidizer. So China, Brazil, and India are having a big laugh. Except the US has not withdrawn this proposal. Unbelievable, but true. 5th, we should have a commodity price stabilization emergency action. Never talked about in this G20 statement. This is the one that hits all the poorest developing countries because their only export is commodities. It also hits the middle-income countries like Brazil or Malaysia. Back to the commodity problem again, commodity prices. Emergency action is the most important if we are going to not have this crisis affect the poor people in developing countries as contrasted to the industrial companies and so on. Finally, developing countries themselves have to get their act together. They have to respond nationally to the right macroeconomic policies like boosting spending, low interest rates, capital controls on outflows, capital controls later on inflows, standstill on debt payment, standstill on portfolio outflow, and repayment of debt according to market rates. Don't pay back 100%, pay back 20, 30, 40 cents, whatever the market says is worth. Developing countries should cooperate regionally so that they can lend each other money, they can stabilize commodity prices by taking action to reduce the output, for example, of palm oil, rubber, whatever it is, coffee. And they should get their act together in formulating what the new international system should look like and inputting that either through the G20, if that continues, and preferably to the United Nations, which is much more democratic. But if the G20 is a game in town, don't give it up. those countries that are not in the G20 should pressurize the other developing countries in the G20 to also represent their view. And in the meanwhile, we should set up the alternative under what is multilateral, the UN or otherwise, that comes forward with a genuine solution. You see, the G20 did not represent many of its views, so it's flawed. Maybe we are too arrogant. Our view is not inside, so it's flawed. But I think my view is more representative of what will help the developing countries than what our own developing country G20 members managed to extract out of that summit. Anyway, that summit was only a beginning. We know the real one is going to be in April. That gives us time to prepare. That gives the Obama people time to prepare. That gives the developing country governments time to prepare. That gives us as civil society time to prepare. Our moment is here. Do we rise to the challenge and prepare and put forward what should be the new alternatives and somehow get it into the G20 summit, but otherwise into other processes as well? I think this is a challenge for us. And I thank CEPR for organizing this session today so that we can all discuss it. Thank you.